It's time to get your goalkeeping groove on with the ultimate at-home goalkeeping workout. Want to top up on your training? Join ex-Premier League stopper Richard Lee from the comfort of your own home. For 30 minutes, three times per week, Rich will take to Instagram Live and run viewers through an easy-to-follow training routine developed from his years of professional experience working with first-class goalkeepers and goalkeeping coaches. Work on and improve speed, strength, technique, and many other aspects of your game while engaging the core muscle groups and athletic ability required to be a top goalkeeper.
Just there, nice and simple. Just right hand to left hand, get the ball moving, get a little bit higher. Good, right into some, straight into some goalkeeping core. So ball out in front, nice squat down and up.
All you need is a few essential household items, a good Wi-Fi connection, and a small space at home. With a weekly mindset session and goalkeeper quiz to boot, consider this your one-stop shop for goalkeeping growth. Join the Joe Wicks of goalkeeping today on a free one-week trial with no obligation to continue. Visit goalkeepersunion.net/workout for more details.
You've been brilliant. You always are. Well done. Great attitude. I'll see you shortly. Take care.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Well, hello there, Matthew.
How are you today, Richard?
Very, very well. Looking forward to this one.
We are. We're weaving our way back into these featured interviews.
See what you've done there. You're very, very clever, aren't you?
Thank you. Start as we shall continue, really, as we've always continued in the same vein. We're going to move on now, of course, to this week's guest, who is a goalkeeper you may have heard on various podcasts in recent years, with so many stories from a varied 19-year career, which brought four promotions, unforgettable celebrations, an appearance in all four divisions of English football in almost as many seasons, lengthy spells on the sidelines, and club sandwich-eating competitions with teammates. He could arguably be described as the man who saved Manchester City. Currently goalkeeper coach at his beloved Sheffield Wednesday, Nicky Weaver. Welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. And as I said at the top there, many people listening to this may have heard your tales from over the years on other podcasts, in particular your chat with the guys from Under the Cosh. Very much worth a listen, that one. Some uncensored brilliance. So if you get a chance, do listen to that particular podcast. We're naturally going to touch on a bit of that too, but we're also going to try and come at it from a slightly different angle to avoid repetition and, you know, focus a little bit more on goalkeeping specifically. We are, however, going to kick it off with the customary opening questions. This is a new feature here for the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Rich, do you fancy doing the honours?
I will do the honours, Matthew. And it is a new feature, something that we want to know about every single goalkeeper. It's something that we found with all the Instagram lives we've been doing. These have been classic questions that get asked time and time again. So, Nicky, first and foremost, what gloves did you wear throughout your career?
I started off wearing All Sport when I sort of broke into the team at City. And then I ended up going to Umbro for 7 or 8 years. And then the last sort of 7 or 8 years of my career, I wore Cells. But I'd have to say, out of them all, Cells were the best.
Yes, to be honest, I was a bit of a salesman myself for many, many years. Well, look, next question. What is the most memorable kit that you've worn?
probably been one that, you know, I wore for Man City, the orange one in the playoff final. It seems to, it's hung on my mum and dad's wall, so it's my favourite kit and probably my most memorable one as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say the orange one. I actually put something out on my Instagram the other day about colourful kits, which you see far more now than you did back then. Look, the final question of this trio of questions that we're going to start every podcast with is, what is your favourite save? Now, before you answer this, it's not necessarily the most memorable save, because often the favourite save or the best save that you make isn't necessarily the one that you make in a playoff final or a Premier League game. It might be one that's made on a Tuesday night in League Two, nobody watching, but you know yourself, it was the best ever save you've made. So, Nicky Weaver, for you, what was the best save you've ever made?
My best ever save, it was, I had a loan spell at Sheffield Wednesday in the 2005-06 season, and it was against Leicester, and it was in front of the Kop, and we were winning 2-1, and it was an injury time, and it was a striker they had called Mark De Vries. I think they'd signed him from Hearts, and it was close in, and he's knocked it. The ball's got pulled back, probably 6 yards out. I'm on my goal line. I've turned to the left. He's hit it low. I've just managed to wedge the ball between like my little finger and the floor. Richard will know exactly what I mean. And somehow managed to claw it back into me before the sort of the flying studs come back in. So that was, for me, my best ever save. Not the most important, but to make a save, you know, in front of the Kop at Hillsborough in the last minute to get you all 3 points was, I don't think I've ever seen it on TV. So, but yeah, for me, that was the best save I've ever made, but probably not the most memorable, if you like.
That often happens. Rich, is that the same for you when you think of your favourite ever save?
Yeah. Do you know what I would say, though, is you often find, or I've often found, that the big saves you make, they just take on a bit more meaning. And obviously, we're going to be talking about obviously a few key ones in particular throughout this podcast. But I do think it is when you make that big one in a big game. I think it's just because the emotions you get and the flow of energy, the adrenaline, it makes it feel that little bit better, if anything. So I always find that as well. You make the better saves in games as opposed to training. And I guess that is the adrenaline, the nerves and everything else that comes with it.
Yeah, I suppose it's the sort of the nearest thing you could do to scoring a last-minute winner, if you like, if you make a big save. And, you know, you do work all week. You make obviously loads of saves throughout the week. But when, you know, the pressure's on and, you know, it's late in the game and it's tight, or, you know, you've been under the cosh all game and you do make that big save, you know, at the end or whatever it is, and it earns your team a point or 3 points, it's, you know, I don't think there's any better feeling.
Okay, well, as per, we shall naturally journey through your career as we're going to go through this podcast, but we must start with the most memorable of occasions, that moment, that career-defining penalty shootout. It was Wednesday, the 6th of October, 2010. Sheffield Wednesday are hosting Chesterfield. It's something of a local derby, you'd have to say. A chance to reach the area quarterfinals of the Johnston's Paint Trophy. You, Nicky, and Tommy Lee go head-to-head. You step up for the deciding penalty in sudden death. Talk us through it.
Yeah, it was a bit of a nothing game. You know, when I arrived there that evening, I didn't a pretty dour game. Obviously, we ended up drawing, went to a penalty shootout. It ended up going all the way around, and it came to me. And I was walking back towards the sort of touchline where the linesman is, and he's sort of pointing, saying, "No, you're going to have to take one." So I thought, oh, you know, I'd never even practiced one in training. So what I had in my head is take a goal kick and just keep your head down. And that's what I did. I had quite a long run up, kept my head down, and I smashed it as hard as I could. And luckily, it went right under the crossbar.
And I was going to say, no, it was fantastic. I was going to say that because I've watched this several times and I think that's unsavable. Because I think even if the goalkeeper stays still, the fact that you've got the height on it, it's got in the roof of the net, hasn't it? It is a goal kick. I've never seen a penalty hit quite so hard.
Yeah, just like I said, it never entered my head before the shootout or during the shootout. I was more obviously concentrating on saving the penalty. Fortunately, I'd managed to save three in that shootout. Two, I think, were in sudden death. So, you know, obviously, I felt good, you know. I just hit it as hard as I could. And, yeah, I sort of aimed right at Tommy's head. And I got it probably a little bit higher than I wanted, but it went probably 6 inches under the crossbar. And me and Tommy have had a little bit of banter about that since.
I love the thinking behind this, Nicky, because what you just said there was you put your head down and took a goal kick. So is that the feeling behind it? You literally think, I'm just going to put my foot through this and take a goal kick and hope that it ends up under the bar?
That was pretty much it. I remember thinking to myself, keep your head down. So if my head had come up too early, then the ball would, you know, gain elevation too early. So yeah, just take a goal kick, but keep your head down. And yeah, that's what I did. And yeah, it was a night that I'll never forget.
And you touched on it there, the fact that it was against Tommy Lee. And for those that don't know, Tommy Lee, of course, worked with you, has just recently left and gone to Sheffield United with the academy, or the 23s, I believe, there now. Obviously, top goalkeeper himself, and I've got no doubt will go on to be a top goalkeeper coach. But you've, of course, been working with him for the last couple of years.
Yeah, so when he first came, we had a bit of banter about it, and it was because it wasn't the winning penalty, man. He had to take his afterwards, and he's tried to go for the top corner, and he's put it, you know, high, wide and mighty. So he went for placement and I went for power. But yeah, we've had a bit of banter about it, but he's a good lad, Tommy. And like you said, he had a great career at Chesterfield. And, you know, from what I've seen the last couple of years working closely with him at Sheffield Wednesday, he's gone on to pastures new at Sheffield United now, but I'm sure he'll be, I think he's only 33, 34, something like that. So he's got many, many years of coaching in front of him.
I tell you what's nice about this as well, Rich, is that we've got another goalkeeper now we can talk about with regards to JPT penalty saving heroics. Nicky, I don't know how many of these podcasts you've listened to, but I'm pretty sure every single one, Rich just manages to weave in the fact that he saved a few penalties against Charlton once.
Well, you've got him at the most of these moments, you see. They don't come around very often, do they, Rich?
This is what I tell Matt from time to time. You know, it's exactly, you look back on your career and how many times do you actually get to be the hero, really? And in fact, I'm pretty sure we're going to touch on another moment.
I'm sure we will. Yes, we're definitely going to get to that. We'll get onto City in 99, but not right now. We're going to leave that for later. Let's start with how you got to City in the first place. And the fact that you effectively, from what I can gather, made quite a big call at such an early age to leave Sheffield Wednesday School of Excellence, which it was at the time, and signed for Mansfield in the bottom tier. You were only, what, 15 years old at the time, Nicky?
Yeah, basically, I was at the Sheffield Wednesday School of Excellence, which is the same as the academy now. And I'd had some injuries with my knees, and I wasn't playing much. They really fancied the other goalkeeper, and they sort of never released me, but I knew that if I'd have stayed there, I wouldn't have got offered a YTS, as it were, then, an apprenticeship. Anyway, for some unbeknown reason to me, I got a phone call. My dad got a phone call one night off Mansfield Town, so, you know, would Nicky like to come and play for us on Sunday? And I think that was towards the end of my under 15 season. So sort of just over a year before you'd enter your scholarship, if as you call it now. So I left Sheffield Wednesday, which was my boyhood club. So it was difficult to leave, but it was the best move I ever made, because I genuinely think if I hadn't have left then, you know, I may never have had a career in the game. And, you know, it was funny, actually, because I went to Mansfield, and within sort of 6-7 months of being there, I'd signed YTS forms and everything. And then during my first year as a YTS, Sheffield Wednesday tried to buy me, which sort of, you know, made me laugh a little bit. But, you know, they kept tabs on me. Our manager at Mansfield was a guy called Andy King, who, bless him, is no longer with us. And he was friends with David Pleat, who was the Sheffield Wednesday manager. And after me making my debut for Mansfield, he got in touch with David Pleat. I went training with Sheffield Wednesday for a couple of days, and they made an offer, but it was declined by Mansfield. So it gave me a little bit of a chuckle inside, because, you know, they'd sort of didn't really put up much of a fight to keep me a couple of years before, and then they're trying to buy me.
Do you know what? And I just want to labour on this a bit, because I think, you know, we're still going to talk about your career a lot, but this is a great example for a lot of young goalkeepers. And we do get a lot of young goalkeepers that listen into this podcast, where to just show such a short period of time to have such a U-turn like that, you know, effectively where you felt like you weren't going to be able to progress with the club and you go away, and to have them show that kind of interest. But it just shows you the fine line in goalkeeping. You see it so often, goalkeepers that maybe don't quite make it to the level you think they would. And similarly, goalkeepers that maybe you write off at a younger age. You know, we had Nick Pope on the podcast not so long ago, and he had to sink into the non-league before he was able to make his way back into the professional game. But it is such a fine line at times.
It is. You've hit the nail on the head there. And it's sort of, it's not how good you are when you're sort of 15 or 16. It's how good you are when you're 19, 20, 21. Even later in some cases, and people develop differently. I mean, I shot, when I was sort of 14, I shot up, and I, you know, I was sort of 6'4", but I looked like Rod Trotter. I was all sort of skin and bone. So it does take a little bit of time for your sort of body to catch up with the height adjustment, and I was all gangly, and also at that point, we didn't have any goalkeeping coaches. I mean, I don't know what your youth career was like, Rich, regarding coaching, but I had to sort of work it out for myself. And it was only actually when I ended up, you know, going to City that I actually worked with a goalkeeping coach. So it was alien to me, and no one had ever told me where to stand, how to catch it, you know, what body position I should be in, what set position I should be in. You just sort of learnt on the job and worked it out for yourself.
So was that goalkeeping coach Alex Stepney?
Yeah, I was at Mansfield and we played a reserve game against City and had a decent game. And Kevin Bond was the Man City reserve manager, and he, said to Alex Stepney, "I like that lad. He had a decent game. Go and watch him next week. They're playing at Stockport." And Alex Stepney watched me next week, and then the next minute City come and bought me. So it was unbelievable. I'd only played one game for Mansfield in the first team, and I'd just come into the end of my second year YTS, and I'd just been offered a contract at Mansfield. I was on £42.50 a week in my second year as an apprentice, and I'd been offered a contract at Mansfield of £125. And, I thought I'd won the lottery. And but before I had a chance to sign it, in came City and ended up signing for City.
We're going to speak to him in a podcast coming up, actually, Alex Stepney. Was he good to work with?
Yeah, Alex was good for me. He pushed me. He was one of the sort of first goalkeeping coaches, if you like. But the sort of, obviously, he's obviously remembered for his Man United days, winning the European Cup in that great, great team. But Alex was great for me. And he sort of pushed me along and he backed me all the way. Once he got me there at City, he worked really hard with me. And he just sort of backed me all the way. And, I'll always be grateful to Alex because he always, obviously he was a lot older than me at the time. I was sort of 18 or so, and Alex would have been 57. So there's a big age difference, and he obviously played in a different era. But, he really pushed me along and helped me out a lot.
Just on that note, how important is that? Because I had a similar thing, I guess, at Watford, as you mentioned, similar sort of era. I had very little goalkeeper coach until I was 18. And then it was Kevin Hitchcock, actually, at Watford came in. And within days, he'd made his decision. For whatever reason, he'd taken a liking to me. And he kept telling me that I was going to be X, Y, and Z. And because of his belief in me and the fact that he pushed me so, so hard. I've never worked so hard in my life. But then the confidence I think I got from that, knowing that someone's got your back in that way, did that make a big difference for you? And how important is that for younger goalkeepers?
I think it is important. It wasn't just Alex Stepney. I mean, I forged a good relationship with Alex, but Tommy Wright, who was, when I first went to City, Tommy Wright, who was now the manager of St Johnstone, and Martin Margaretson, who was the England goalkeeper coach. Now, they were the two goalkeepers, so they helped me out a lot as well. And I remember Tommy had sometimes pull me to one side and do a little bit extra with me. So it wasn't just Alex, it was Tommy and Martin as well. And Joe Royal was huge for me as well, because I'd been at City sort of 7 or 8 months. Frank Clark took me there, and Frank Clark unfortunately got sacked, and Joe Royal came in. And sort of a bit like you just said there with Kevin, it obviously instantly took a bit of a like to me. And and it was Joe Royal who gave him a debut for City in front of Tommy Wright, which at the time, Tommy was a Northern Ireland international, played for many, many years. So I was very surprised, but also very grateful to get that chance.
So you moved on to City. Am I right, Nicky, in saying that you played in all four divisions in pretty much nearly as many seasons?
Yeah, well, I only ever played one game in League Two for Mansfield. And fortunately enough, I ended up getting the move to City. So yeah, and then obviously when I broke into the City team, it was the third tier. And then we got back-to-back promotion, so I went straight into the Championship, straight into the Premier League. So yeah, in sort of 4 years, or 4.5 years, I played in all four divisions. When I first went to City, it was unbelievable because I'd come from Mansfield Town where, they didn't really have a training ground. There was sort of no canteen. It was just, a bit sort of rag-ass Rovers, really. There was no training kit. It was just, it was what it was, And then to get a move to Man City, and I remember walking in on the first day. I'll never forget the day I signed. I went over with mum and dad. I just turned 18 and met Frank Clark, the manager. Francis Lee was there, Colin Bell, Mike Summerby. And my dad, was in his element looking at all these, England legends and what have you. And I signed. And I remember the walking in the next day, very nervous. And these people, there was, Georgie Kinkladze and Uwe Rosler and Nigel Clough, and I'm just looking around thinking, wow. And the only time I'd ever seen these guys were on the TV. So you're suddenly thinking, wow, and you're suddenly sat in the dressing room there, and it's just, and I always remember the first time I ever went in and I got a training kit off the kit man, and I couldn't believe it. I'm thinking, well, I've got an Umbro towel, and I'm like, I've got some tracksuit bottoms and a top, and I've even got a wet top. And I just sort of, because at Mansfield we didn't have any of that sort of stuff, so it was the little things that made a big impression on me at first. Because when you're young and you get a bit of gear and stuff and a couple of tracksuits, you think it's great. So yeah, it was a huge sort of transition for me, but one that, was brilliant at the time.
Yeah, no, perfect move, perfect time. I want to ask you actually about Uwe Rosler, because there's a couple of people we've got in common, and he's one of them, obviously manager of Brentford, and I've worked with him for a couple of years, and really, really interesting character. So for those who don't know too much about him, certainly my experience of him as a manager, very, very forthright, very strong in his opinions, did a really good job at Brentford and eventually then moved on to Wigan. What was he like to play with?
Like I say, I was only a young lad, and Uwe was a big fan's favourite. Sort of quite a... I got on with him, and whenever I see him now, I really get on with him. Quite a sort of intense guy, but yeah. He did have a sort of a German sense of humour. You'll understand what I mean, knowing him. He did like a bit of a laugh at times, but he could be very sort of sensible and a bit sort of stiff at other times, if you like. But he was a good player, you know, in his pomp at City. He was a top player. And the fans still love him now, and you know, he's gone on to be a good manager. And yeah, it was a good lad. I only had a year with him there, so I wasn't actually in the team when Uwe was there. But it was always, you know, good to me. I've seen him at many City do since, and he's a nice fellow, Uwe, and it was a great player.
And just one other player, just to mention, you touched on him there, but Georgia King-Gladzi was a massive, massive fans' favourite, if I remember. Like, fantastic player from what I remember. Again, just a quick word on him. How was he to train with?
Yeah, talent-wise, it was up there. I mean, his career was sort of disappointing for the amount of talent he had. I've never seen anyone run so quick and then stop in sort of one step. It really was unbelievable. The problem Georgia had at City is he got relegated a couple of times, so he never actually played in sort of winning teams. He just showed flashes and moments of genius. And I think he went off to Ajax there, and then he came back to Derby. But for the sort of talent he had, he was unbelievable and should have perhaps gone on to play for like one of the elite clubs, you know, in the country.
Yeah, some incredible characters when you first signed. You mentioned Tommy Wright as well. Martin Margenson were the goalkeepers pretty much at the time. A bit later on, Carlo Nash was there for a bit. Simon Royce, who, Rich, I believe you played with as well. I think at Brentford, maybe. A couple of randoms as well, by the way. I hold my hands up here. I completely forgot about these guys. Geert De Vlieger and Roland Waterhouse are two goalkeepers that I absolutely cannot remember. But then we are talking about some absolute behemoths in the goalkeeping world. You've got Peter Schmeichel. You've got David Seaman. You've got David James. Some massive goalkeepers that you were alongside there.
Yeah, absolutely huge names. But it's only when you sort of look back, you realise, I mean, you mentioned Ronald Waterhouse there. He was a Dutch international. He played at the top level. And the other guy, Geert De Vlieger, he's had something like 50 caps for Belgium. Mm. But then, yeah, obviously, Peter Schmeichel came. We got promoted under Kevin Keegan. And it was me and Carlo Nash sort of shared the promotion season. I got injured towards the end of the season. So Nashy played the back end of that. And that's when Royce came in. And then suddenly we signed Peter Schmeichel. And I knew it was coming because I had the same agent as Peter Schmeichel. And it was just like, wow, it's Peter Schmeichel. And the sort of, the presence of the man. I've probably never seen a player or goalkeeper with a presence like Pete. He was just a man mountain. And on a match day, you sort of, not that you wouldn't engage in conversation with him, but you sort of trod very carefully around him because he was so focused and in the zone. But lovely guy, didn't train much, sort of wheeled him out on a Saturday and he sort of did the business for us, but he barely trained. He liked to train with the outfield players, did Pete, just doing, you know, the little boxes and stuff. He liked all that. And then he left, and I think Kevin Keegan must have been buoyed, you know, by what Pete did. So he brought in David Seaman, who had left Arsenal. Unfortunately for Dave, it was probably, well, obviously, he was 39 at the time, so he was on his sort of last legs, and he ended up retiring in like the January, I think, with a shoulder injury. But what a great guy. Lovely fella. Completely opposite to Pete. Really relaxed. Twiddling with his ponytail. Chewing his gum. But just a really, really nice bloke. And he was a fella, a Yorkshireman like myself. Grew up probably 20 minutes from where I grew up. And just a lovely bloke, but you couldn't really get too more contrasting characters. And then I think it was the January when he retired. Then the next minute, David James is there. So, yeah. You know, just it was one great after another. And with David James, if you could, you know, get a sketch pad out and draw yourself the perfect goalkeeper, it would be David James. He was, I mean, I won't get in the shower next to J-Mo, like, because he, You know what I mean? He was everything I wasn't in every level sense of the word. But he's just a decent guy, Jamie. And he had muscle on muscle. Just even like, I don't know, when he was eating, he had cheek muscles and stuff. And it was just an absolute physical specimen. There were days in training where he did things that you just, you know, you thought were impossible, and he could make the most difficult things look so easy. But yeah, just such a fantastic and talented goalkeeper J-Mo was.
Well, you know, as much as this podcast is obviously very much about you, this is going to be the fanboy of me that comes out, which wants to know a little bit more about Schmeichel, Seaman, James. We talk on this podcast a lot about the variety of goalkeepers and how it isn't a one-size-fits-all. You know, you just touched on it there. You've got three so different. You know, David James, I always remember there was an image that came out. He must have been pre-season. And as you say, this specimen that you could just see, there was not an ounce of fat on him. Absolutely perfect in terms of what you would want from a goalkeeper in terms of, obviously, size, shape, spring, power, just had absolutely everything. Then David Seaman, just a very different character, looking from the outside, so, so calm in everything that he did for Arsenal. But then you've got Schmeichel, as intense as he was. I guess I'd love to know a little bit more about Peter Schmeichel in particular, because, I mean, I was a Man United fan as a kid, so watching him growing up and, you know, I used to get there early, watching his warm-ups and what have you. I guess you got him at the tail end of his career, but he didn't train too much. You mentioned that. But what was he like physically? What, for you, were the main parts of his game that made him such a great, other than his personality?
Just his presence. I mean, I think Pete, he sort of changed the face of goalkeeping. He came over sort of at the start of the Premier League era, and he was just massive. He was doing the big starfish. And I think he sort of changed the sort of way managers looked at goalkeepers. I think after Pete came, every manager sort of wanted a 6'5" monster, if you like. So I think Pete has probably had the biggest influence in goalkeeping in this country in recent times, really. And yeah, it was, like I say, it was just really focused, really driven, really intense, particularly around a match. I just remember when he walked in, it was like, wow, it's Peter Schmeichel. And you're going out just doing some handling drills and what have you. Like, I was injured for a bit of the time when Pete was there. And then, after, you know what it's like, you've played with big players yourself, Richie. It just becomes Pete. I'm only Pete. And, but it's just that initial first few times you see him, you're just like, wow, you're in presence of sort of greatness, if you like. Like we said, he was at the end of his career, but he still produced the goods. I remember one particular game away at Liverpool, he made a fantastic save, tipped it onto the bar. And yeah, he could still produce big saves at big moments, which he sort of did all throughout his career.
Just to finish on David James, I've heard you speak before about J-Mo having what was supposed to be a water jug or a water flask or a water bottle, and he filled it up with coffee. Is that right?
Yeah, he used to come out and he used to have the big, remember the blue and yellow Lucozade bottles? He used to fill it up with coffee. He used to love coffee. He'd sort of, and I remember saying to him once, he was like yawning. I said, "Oh, you tired?" He said, "Yeah, I was up till 3 a.m. logging my gloves." I said, "What do you mean logging your gloves?" He's like, "Yeah, I swap gloves with other goalkeepers. I've got gloves I've played with, and I've got little pigeonholes for him. I log them all." And so it was a little bit like that. And he also had a book as well that he used to write down. He's quite big on the psychology part of it, J-Mo. And he used to write down every goal he conceded. Was it, you know, inside the 6-yard box, outside the 18-yard box? Was it header, left foot, right foot? And he sort of, so he'd fill that in. But I always remember we turned up once at Stamford Bridge and I was on the bench. And he put his gloves on the table on the coach as we pulled in to Stamford Bridge. And I touched his gloves. I picked them up. I'm going to try one on. And he nearly ripped my head off. He's like, "Don't touch them. You can't touch them." I'm like, "Why?" And he's like, "Nah, it's bad luck. It's bad luck." And I'm like, "Okay, sorry, J-Mo." Like, I sort of like half melting into the chair. And anyway, he was fine about it. But he had a bit of a thing that no one was allowed to touch his gloves. And I said to him, I said, "Are they the only pair you've got?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Don't you bring a spare pair?" And he went, "No." I said, "Well, what would you do if they ripped in the warm-up?" He said, "Well, I'd just see it as a challenge." So that was J-Mo, like, a little bit different. But, yeah. But it was at Chelsea, and he always had a good game at Chelsea, J-Mo. Always had a good game there.
Joe, it's such a shame, actually. We were due to have David James. I've got a goalkeeping dinner, which you've had to now put back. It was due to be in March, and unfortunately, you've had to put it back, and now probably going to have to put it back until next year. But he is one because, again, just looking from the outside, just such a fascinating character from a lot of the stuff you'd read. I know he's quite into his art, isn't he? And he's gone into a few different things now post-football. But for me, one of the most positive goalkeepers that I've seen. You know, obviously he was kind of, he got a bit of stick for coming for crosses and not always necessarily getting them. But he certainly came, when I'd watched him anyway, came for a lot more. One of the most effective goalkeepers I've ever seen.
Yeah, he would come. And like I said, I think to us earlier, he could do things. We used to, Tim Flowers was the goalkeeping coach when JMO was there. And he used to put crossing sessions in and we'd get some of the youth team players to hang crosses up, attack crosses. But the youth team players would be like Ishmael Miller, Micah Richards, Nader Manua. So they're all sort of big guys, got good leaps on them. And we're getting balls whipped in. And JMO would just, his arms would just come and he'd take balls. They'd be like 12 and 14 foot in the air. And he just made it look so easy. And he'd take them one-handed. And he's, when he was on, his timing was unbelievable. And you sort of, no one could put a sort of cross within 8 yards of the goal. And JMO, without JMO coming and gobbling it up. Obviously, there were times where he'd probably come fishing a little bit and probably got a little bit excited. But that was, you know, when it, I think he was at City 2.5 years, JMO, and he barely put a foot wrong. He was England's number one at the time, and he was absolutely brilliant. He barely put a foot wrong. I think, obviously, he made some high-profile errors at Liverpool, and it sort of stuck with him, and a couple for England, perhaps. But it sort of stuck with him. But certainly at the time at City, he had a fantastic time there. And he like I said, for 2.5 years, he was brilliant.
Just to finish on the fanboy stuff, as Rich quite poignantly put it, you played with Kasper Schmeichel. He was there at least for a bit as well. So you played alongside father and son. But Joe Hart was just starting his City career as well, pretty much as you were about to leave the club. Did you see then in Joe Hart, the youngster coming over from Shrewsbury, that he'd go on to have the success that he ended up having?
Yeah. Obviously, Joe came in when he was 18 from Shrewsbury. I think the good thing when Joe came in, he played sort of 50 or 60 games for Shrewsbury, a few in League Two and a few in the like season in the Conference. So he'd sort of, it served his apprenticeship really. And when he came in, he was 18 and he was a man already, almost. Like, he had a great physique on him, a good sort of strong body, thick arms, you know, kicked it a mile. And yeah, he had a couple of loan spells. I think he went out to Tranmere and Blackpool possibly. And yeah, but you could see, like, I don't think you can ever say 18 he's going to play 75 times for England and win the Premier League and this, but you could see, you know, he was going to be a top keeper. And touching on Kasper, a little bit different Kasper, because Kasper, I always say to the young lads at Sheffield Wednesday now when I'm working with them, Kasper gets everything he deserves, because I've never seen a goalkeeper work as hard as Kasper works in training. He used to, and if he had a bad day, he'd be shouting at himself, he'd be kicking the wall, he'd be throwing his gloves about. Probably a little bit immature at times in his behaviour, but obviously he matured out of that. A bit petulant when he was younger, Kasper, but he gets everything he deserves because, you know, he's carved a career out now in his own right where he was always Peter Schmeichel's son. But yeah, two great lads, both there together. I always remember going to Kasper's 18th birthday party, and on Monday morning I came in and Kasper pulled me and said, "Oh, can you remember what he said to my sister on Saturday night?" And I'm thinking, oh no, please. I'm going to have Big Pete bashing my front door down here. And I'm like, what did I say? And I think I said something along the lines of, "Oh, when you're older, you don't end up with anyone like me," something like that. So I was quite relieved that I didn't say anything that would have aggregated Big Pete.
That could have been a lot worse, a hell of a lot worse.
Weaver's gone down without apparent cause. But they are making a goalkeeping change now. Nicky Weaver clearly isn't okay to carry on.
We're going to touch a bit on injuries now, because your story is, well, it's quite incredible, really. I know that you've talked about this a lot, so I'll just quickly give the details so you don't have to go over it. To very quickly break it down, 5th of March 2002 was when you injured your knee in a game against Birmingham. You were in your early 20s. At the time, City went up as champions of the Championship that season. You did not start another game for almost 5 years. That came against Chelsea back in the Premier League in August 2006. Quite incredible, really, the fact that you managed to beat that injury and come back from it. But just talk us through that time and what you went through and the operations, etc., etc.
Yeah, it was basically, like I said, I hurt my knee at Birmingham. It looked like it was just a simple cartilage tear. So I had a little operation, 5 or 6 weeks, thinking, yeah, I'll be back. Did my rehab, just about to start training. Knee flared up a little bit. So they went back in, tidied it up again, said, oh, there's a couple of loose bodies floating about. And then I rehabbed again, and the same thing happened again. And then it was a little bit like, okay, well, this is not quite right. So I had two operations, and, you know, my knee was just flaring up, and it was huge, and I couldn't get rid of the swelling, and it was crunching and clicking and all this. And at the time, we had Paolo Wanchop, who had knee problems, and he'd been over to see a guy in Cleveland, Ohio, a place called the Cleveland Clinic. So the physios basically said, listen, we don't really know what's going on with your knee, but we're quite keen to send you to America. At this point, I'm obviously panicking a little bit, thinking, well, if I've got to sort of fly halfway around the world and they don't know what's up with my knee in this country sort of thing. Anyway, cut a long story short, I went over to America. I had an operation over there, came back, same thing happened again, went over, had another operation, same thing happened again. So at this point, I've had four operations and it's still not right. And then I went back over there and then had a big operation, which was to take a meniscus, which basically is your cartilage, out of a dead person, out of a corpse, and then implant it into my knee, which was, I was the first British footballer ever to have this done. They didn't do the procedure at the time in Europe, but they basically said to me, it's the only chance you've got of saving your career. So I had the operation, and they give me sort of a 70-30 chance of it being successful, which obviously it's stacked in my favour, but it's not great odds when you're sort of, you know, 30% is a big chunk when you're thinking it's your career and your livelihood on the line. And yeah, I remember I come back from having the operation. I didn't have a drink for a year. I lived like a monk for a year. I did everything in my power to get fit because I knew I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I'd not done my rehab properly and had to retire. I've always been that question there. What if I could have? So I made sure there were no more that I could have done. Unfortunately, you know, after a year of that last operation, I got back to full fitness.
Joyce, incredible story. I mean, what's the cliche? If it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. So, I mean, I've got to ask you, during that time when you've had failed attempts over and over and over, which is none of your problems, it's nothing that you've done wrong, and yet every time you're breaking down, how was that mentally? How did you deal with that?
The first probably couple of times, I was like, oh, okay, it's no problem. I'll just have another operation. But it was when I first went to America, they sort of touched on, I may have to have this big operation, but they'd want to do a couple of other things first. So it was just, when I look back, it was just one big blur because it was all the same, because the rehab was all the same for sort of 3 years, whatever it was. But yeah, mentally, it was luckily probably 5 or 6 months before I got injured, I'd just signed a new 5-year contract, so I did have time on my hands, so that was really fortunate. And I was lucky that I was at a club like City who would pay for me to go over to America. I mean, I remember going once just for a scan, just to make sure everything was okay. But yeah, it was sort of dark times, and a lot of players say that they nearly retired, but it got to the point where the club doctor was sort of informing the club insurers and my own personal insurance company of my progress, because it looked like the club and myself were going to have to make a claim and I was going to have to retire. At one bit, it looked like, you know, I wasn't going to make it. But, you know, fortunately, I did. And, you know, I played on for sort of like another 10 years after that.
Yeah, incredible. And we're going to touch on, obviously, your comeback and how that felt. But just out of interest, how does it feel now? Do you get any issues with it now? Or is it as good as 100%?
Yeah, it's not good. I mean, I ended up having another operation on it in 2012, I think it was, when I was playing for Sheffield Wednesday. So I played for sort of like 6 or 7 years with it, and it was fine. It was never the same as it was, but it was fine. And then I tore the cartilage that it transplanted in, and I just tore that a little bit at Sheffield Wednesday. Went back to America to see the same guy, had it cleaned up, but I was never the same after that. And the last sort of couple of years, I really struggled with it. I'm sort of okay now. You know, I don't lash balls around in training as much as I used to. So I do limit how much sort of kicking and what have you I do in training, serving obviously the lads. But it's okay. I'm sort of fine with it. I'd have sort of, at 25, I'd have took it now. What it's like in another 10 years, I'm not sure. But yeah, it's sort of okay.
Just on the cartilage that you had put in, Nicky, just to finish on this, is there anything, I don't know, is there anything in the psychology of having a dead person's cartilage inserted into your own body, and around that whole story, are you able to, I don't know, do you know the family of the guy whose cartilage it was?
No, it didn't bother me because I'd have done anything just to play, you know, just to get back. So that I didn't have an issue with a dead person's cartilage. I did actually ask at the hospital if there was any way I could get sort of the details of the family of the person who I had the cartilage off, because ultimately someone's lost their life, but that's ultimately, I know it's only a tiny little piece, but that ultimately saved my career. And I just thought it would have been nice to just to let them know, in obviously a family's suffered a sort of huge tragedy, that just that, you know, that me halfway around the world of grateful for their loss, if you like, without, you know. So yeah, I did try and find out, but they're not allowed to do it. I think it's all confidentiality and what have you. So yeah, but it would have been nice. But yeah, it's something that, you know, I don't really think about. At the time, there was quite a lot made of it. And yeah, I kept in touch with the surgeon for quite a few years, because he ultimately saved my career. And yeah, in fact, I only spoke to him probably 3 or 4 years ago. So yeah, huge thanks to them over there for sort of saving my career. Because if Man City hadn't sent me over to America, I think I would have had to retire.
And it's funny how things work out, isn't it? Obviously, you were out for such a long time with injury. David James moved on to Portsmouth in that summer of 2006. Andreas Isaksson, the Swedish goalkeeper, had been brought in, but he then got injured, and you made your comeback against Chelsea on the opening day.
Yeah, it was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I'd had a loan spell at Sheffield Wednesday at Christmas time the year before, and I played 14 games. That was a huge part of my comeback. That got me sort of back to a level I needed to be at. We signed Joe Hart in the summer. So at one point, we had Joe Hart, Andreas Isaksson and David James. And I'm thinking, well, this is marvellous, like, you know. Anyway, the next minute, Harty was only 18 at the time. James had moved on to Portsmouth. Andreas had just played every game in the World Cup for Sweden. He was going to start the season. The day before we played Chelsea with the champions, he tweaked his ankle, I think it was, and Stuart Pearce turned around and said, right, you're playing tomorrow. So I was like, great. And I think I played 31 games that year. And I sort of class that as my biggest achievement in football, because from where I was, you know, everyone had written me off. I was just in the gym like for years. I never even, you know, and then I come back training breakdown. So I was just like, people had just written me off. And then for me to get back and get my chance, and then to actually, Andreas wasn't out for that long, and then for me to stay in the team, and Stuart Pearce, to be fair to him, kept me in the team when he could have put Andreas in his, you know, £2.5 million he paid for him. You know, I'll always be thankful to Pearson for that. But, you know, I felt at the time I deserved to stay in because my performances sort of, you know, dictated that. But, yeah, just that for me is the biggest achievement I had in my career, because where I'd been to get back and play in the Premier League, you know, was absolutely fantastic.
You know, I was going to leave this a bit later, but you've mentioned Stuart Pearce, so I'll bring it up now. Of course, the final day of the season prior, a couple of seasons prior, where Manchester City played Middlesbrough, of course, for that place in the Europa League. It's much talked about. David James goes up front. You come on to play the last 10 minutes or so. I'd like to ask you about Tim Flowers, because as a player, Tim Flowers was someone that always struck me as a player who smiled a lot. He played with fun. He had a bit of a laugh and a joke, but I could be wrong here. When he went into managing and coaching, and obviously he had a decent spell with Solihull Moors, I think it was recently, wasn't it, before he left that post, I've never seen him smile. It's like he's become the most serious man when he stopped playing football. Was he fun to work with as an assistant coach, as a goalkeeper coach?
Yeah, he was brilliant, Tim. Great character, great lad. I think that's what management must have done to him. But yeah, he was one of my favourite goalie coaches, Tim. I loved him to bits. I can remember him playing, so he was, you know, probably, you know, only sort of 12 years older than me. So when I was a kid, I can remember him playing for England and Southampton and Blackburn, winning the Premier League and all that. So yeah, just a great character, a great bloke, good coach, really enjoyed his sessions. And I feel that, you know, Tim had a big influence on my career in that particular season going forward after Tim left. But also now when I'm a coach, a lot of sessions I do are what Tim used to do. And yeah, I couldn't speak highly enough of Tim. I liked being in his company. He used to make me laugh, you know, and yeah, just we just got on great, and he was just a great lad. And yeah, just a genuinely nice guy. Got a lot of time for Tim.
And he hadn't mentioned anything to you about coming on for the final 10 minutes in that game?
No one had mentioned anything. It was bizarre. I was just sat on the bench. We played Middlesbrough, last game of the season. It was 1-1, I think it was. And we had to beat Middlesbrough to finish above them to get into Europe. So as it stands, it's 1-1, Middlesbrough in Europe. And there's about 10 minutes to go. And Stuart, Tim Flowers just turned around and said, Weaves, get warmed up.
And I'm thinking, what's he on about here? And then like a couple more minutes passed, and then he just went, "Weaves, get ready, you're going on." And I was I'm trying to work out what was happening. I'm thinking, because I'd not been back from injury that long. I'm thinking he can't just be putting me on to say sort of well done for getting back from injury in a big game like this. Then the next minute, I saw the kit man, Les Chapman, pull out a James 1 outfield shirt. And then I was suddenly thinking, oh, right. So I'm sat next to John Macken. Bearing in mind, we'd paid $5 million for John. He wasn't, and then we sort of worked out what was happening, and John wasn't best pleased. So, yeah, it was a bit surreal. So Claudio Reyna came off. I went on. J-Mo went up front. That was the first time I'd ever played a proper game at the Etihad. And I always remember the reception I got, which was brilliant, because that was my sort of first appearance since my injuries. So that was really good. And ultimately, J-Mo sort of caused a bit of havoc. It was a bit of a sort of comedy moment, but, you know, 93rd, 94th minute, we got a penalty. And actually remember making a save off Stuart Downing. He came through in the last couple of minutes. Anyway, we got a penalty late on, and you'd have sort of, you'd have put your life on Robbie Fowler scoring, but Mark Schwartz already made a great save, and off Middlesbrough went into Europe. But yeah, I always remember that was my girlfriend's first ever game. And she said to me after, she said, does that happen all the time? I said, no, that probably never happened, you know, in our lifetime again. But it nearly paid off. It gets brought up a lot now, and people, you know, make a bit about it. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't complaining because it got me back on the pitch.
I mean, a lot of people talk about, like you said, the moment itself. Was there any discussion in the changing room after the game between you, between J-Mo, between Macken, between Claudio Reyna? Were people talking about it in the dressing room afterwards?
I just said to J-Mo, I said, did you know about that then? And he just said, what, the plan? And he's just described as the plan. And I think, as far as I know, I mean, Stuart Pearce is the one who, I mean, the kit man obviously knew because he had to print the shirt up. Yeah. David James obviously knew because he was the one who was going to have to go and actually go up front. But I think Stuart Pearce might have told J-Mo pretty close to the game, or maybe even at half time. I'm not sure. And Steve Wigley, who was the assistant to Stuart Pearce, he must have known. I'm sure Pearce must have, you know, mentioned it to him as well. But as far as I know, there's only sort of three or four people knew. I didn't know. But yeah, it was just a bizarre moment, and probably one that you'll never see again. But it nearly worked, and. You know, I think someone put a cross in as well, and J-Mo sort of nearly got on the end of it. And I think he must have fouled, you know, all of their back four at some point in his sort of 7 or 8 minutes or whatever it was. But yeah, it was. I think in the dressing room after, it was a bit mixed emotions for me, because obviously everyone was disappointed that we didn't win the game and go into Europe. But for me personally, I was just buzzing to be sort of back out on the pitch, having the years of injury nightmares that I'd had. So I was buzzing, obviously, to back out on the pitch, but. Sort of disappointed that we didn't go into Europe.
Speaking of bizarre moments, we're just going to touch on your time north of the border in Scotland. You had a couple of spells up there, one with Aberdeen towards the tail end of your career, but before that with Dundee United. We've had a few goalkeepers on the podcast talk about times where they've been pelted with Tony Parks. It was marshmallows, bizarrely. David Coles said he had a hot dog launched at his calf in one particular game, I think at Southampton. For you, that final game that you had for Dundee United, you were hammered by snowballs in a game against Aberdeen. Is that right?
Yeah, it was over Christmas time. It was at Tannadice, and went in at half time. And then I had to go up to the far end of the pitch. The tunnel was in the corner, so I had to go right to the far end of the pitch in the second half. It snowed a lot at half time. And the back of the stand, where they went and get the pies and the pints half time, whatever, wasn't covered. So it was snowing quite heavily, as it did in Scotland a lot. And I've come out second half, and all the Aberdeen fans are just waiting for me to sort of walk up to put my stuff in the, like my towel in the goal. And they pelted me, and one got me a tree on the side of the head. And yeah, I'll never forget it. And then when I signed for Aberdeen, everybody claimed to have thrown that particular snowball that hit me. But yeah. A bit of a funny moment, and hey, listen, you know, it didn't really bother me. I'm quite an easygoing kind of guy, so I saw the funny side of it. And if I'd have been in the stand, I'd have probably done the same as well.
You didn't consider throwing one back?
Well, if I'd have thrown one back, I'd have 10,000 more coming at me. So, but yeah, it was funny. And I just remember, they were coming at me from all angles. There was only one that got me, but it was a good shot, whoever threw it.
Okay, well, look, I think it's time that we have to get on to the elephant in the room. Everyone knows the story, don't they? City had lost 55 of 130 games on their way to two relegations in 3 years. Didn't have the best start to life in the third tier either, but you clawed your way back, culminated in the playoff final with Gillingham. You bagged 26 clean sheets, which was a club record at the time. You're only 20 years old at the time as well, which is incredible. I think that can be forgotten, just how young you were then. Everyone talks about the last minute Dickoff goal, the celebration after the penalties, but let's try and look at the game itself and your involvement in it up to those penalties. I mean, do you remember much about the game before the penalties?
Not really, because it was a pretty dull, damp, drizzly day at Wembley. And it was a really, really poor game. Not really much happened. Vince Bartram in the other end, he was best mates with Paul Dickoff. And he made quite a few saves, quite a few off Dickie as well. I remember I got away with one, actually. I think I came down sort of my left side, a ball over the top, and I've gone to clear it. I've sort of scuffed my clearance a little bit. And it went to one of their midfield players and had a long-range shot from probably 40 yards. It just went wide, but no one ever mentions that, which is quite good. So I could have been the villain in the end. But yeah, and nothing really happened for me in the game. It was a pretty quiet game for me. I remember making one save early on. And I think I had to tip another one round. But yeah, there were nothing. I wasn't overworked for sure. And they just obviously scored, you know, two late goals. And at two down, you sort of think you're done.
Well, do you know what? I think this is your memory playing tricks on you again here, Nicky, because I often accuse Richard of this. In fact, his memory is completely distorted about some of the games that he played. You say you touch one round. I've watched the highlights naturally and had a good old look through. And the save you made in the first half, relatively routine. But late on in the game, after Carlos Arbour had put Gillingham into the lead, you made one heck of a save from Rob Taylor. I know that Rich has seen this one as well. He was through on goal. And actually, the ref and the lino missed it. And often we talk about goalkeepers who try and give an act to just show that they definitely got a touch, even though the referee has given a goal kick. But you made a great save, tipped it onto the post.
Yeah, I sort of remember it. It was like dipping over my head, I think. And I ended up, I think it must have moved, because I ended up sort of, it was a sort of funny save, but I just got to, and I think the camera angle was perfect in line, so it could show the touch, but like I said, it didn't. I didn't get sort of credited with it because it was a goal kick. But yeah, it was a decent save, I suppose, and one that, you know, it's amazing that game, because everyone asked me about the game, but they just want to get to the penalties, so you sort of bypass the game. Funny enough, I mean, Carlos Arbour scored his first goal. And it was a decent finish, like his toe poked it right over my shoulder, you know, from close range. So I sort of had no chance with that one. And then the second one, I was a bit too far advanced. I was showing him too much of a near post, Bob Taylor. We later signed, actually. But yeah, so I probably should have done better with the second goal. But yeah, just the most remarkable sort of 6 or 7 minutes that you could ever imagine. And Kevin Orlock scored sort of 89th minute, and everyone just thought it was a consolation. A big thing was when Mark Olsey indicated, there was a referee, indicated to the fourth official, you know, there was 5 minutes injury time, which was huge. And I can picture Tony Pulis now sort of going mental on the touchline. He really wasn't happy. And then Dickie, you know, a chance fell to him, and he had a great first touch, and he's managed to find the sort of stanchion, if you like. And it was probably the hardest chance he had all afternoon. And, you know, I just remember seeing the net bulge, and it was just like, wow, we've done it. And even then, it was like, I mean, it was celebrated like a winning goal, you know, and it's talked about like a winning goal. Obviously, it was only the equaliser, but yeah, it was, and I think once that happened, you know, it was written in the stars.
It's funny. So me and Matt do a lot of podcasts on various things. We've done one recently on Peter Shilton, which was quite an interesting podcast, and looking through a few of the goals he conceded in Italia 90. And we speak a lot about sliding doors, you know, moments that could have been so different, and how, for instance, Peter Shilton got a little bit of stick for a couple of the goals that were conceded, for instance. Whereas we'll look at, say, a Peter Schmeichel, and he is just a legend. However, you wonder, had they have lost that game to Bayern Munich, for instance, you know, would people have blamed him for the goal? Would it have been a completely different story? And I suppose I look at this game, and you mentioned it, for me, it was a fantastic save, by the way. So 1-0 down, and you mentioned you're almost going the wrong way. It is a funny save, because you're kind of moving one side, your body going the other, and the fingertips, you know, to get it around the post. Unbelievable save, which again, you wonder if that goes in, it would have changed the course of the game. The goal you conceded, you touched on maybe a little bit too far down the line. I'm sure you now as a coach, I'd be interested, you know, you looking back and analysing yourself. Then, of course, being the hero later on in that game. It's just so funny how it can swing back and forth and just the smallest moments. We're talking literally inches. What's the any given Sunday quote? You know, inches are everywhere. And it really is. Like, that game for you could have gone so many different ways. In the end, just have the perfect ending that it did. It must have been a phenomenal evening.
It was. I mean, it was just, like you said in the introduction to the game, I kept 26 clean. My first season playing at City, I've kept 26 clean sheets. So I broke the club's clean sheet record. I played 55 games that season. And I've never played as many in one season in my career again. So it was just unbelievable. And obviously, you know, for it to end, you know, with the penalties, just sort of, you know, sort of goose pimples. So when I talk about it and the hairs on the back of your neck sort of thing. And it was I suppose it sort of put me on the map as a keeper, you know, at an early age, really. And it was all downhill from there, pretty much afterwards. But, just great times. And, you know, I remember someone saying to me after, oh, you'll be dining out on that for 20 years. And I'm like, nah, give up. And 21 years later, whenever I'm in Manchester, that's all people want to talk to me about. You know, I was there 10 years at City. And all they want to talk to me about is that one game. So it was just such a... And I think the thing is as well, it's because how well City have done in recent years, you know, winning Premier Leagues, going far in Champions Leagues, best manager in the world, playing some of the best football. I think it makes the story sort of romantic that they start. That was almost sort of like where the first rung on the ladder, if you like. I think if City had just been like a run-of-the-mill Premier League team, not as much would have been made about the game as it is. But, you know, for me to have played a part in the game and it to get talked about like it does is something I'm really proud of. And it's not just for me, but for my family as well. Because, you know, I probably think about that game. It probably crossed my mind every day at some point because someone will mention it to me or I'll see, I don't know, something on... So whatever it is, it'll always pop into my head, that game.
It's funny that I know that Rich, you spoke to Joe Hart recently, he said something similar about 2012. You know, a day can't go by without that passing through his mind because it's just impossible for it not to. To be fair, he's got a giant mural of it in his house, I think. So it's almost impossible for him to ignore. But it was so pivotal, Nicky, because... You know, I actually saw you guys play that season. I was at the game towards the end of the season where you lost at home to Wickham in the final three games of the season and ended up obviously going into those playoff places. And you're right, every team that came up against Manchester City that season wanted to beat them. Had City not gone up that season, you never quite know where they might be now.
No, it was I listened to an interview with David Bernstein, who was the chairman at the time, and he said, you know, it was a big part of us getting the Commonwealth Stadium as well, which obviously is the Etihad now. City needed to get back towards the Premier League, you know, and if they didn't, then the stadium might never have happened. So, you know, it is what it is, I suppose. And it's just a huge game for all the lads who played in it. But I think for the club as a whole, it's the lowest the club had ever been. Only had one year in that division, fortunately. And who knows, if we hadn't won that game, how many years it might have took us to get out of the division and things might have been very, very different.
Just lastly, before we move on to Sheffield Wednesday and your time now as a goalkeeper coach, I just want to ask you, I'm intrigued to know whether you can remember, but I saw as you were walking two penalties before they started, you were chatting to Vince Bartram, the Gillingham goalkeeper. Can you remember what you guys were talking about?
Nah, I can't remember what I did yesterday. What I was chatting to Vince about. No, I can't remember. I think as goalkeepers, you know, Rich will tell you, when you go into a shootout, the shootouts that I've been involved in, I've always been really relaxed because there's no pressure on you. You can have a gamble, you just dive one way or the other or stand bigger, you know, and all the pressure's on the player. So I think it's sort of, you know, for me, I sort of felt so relaxed going in. I do think a big thing was that the penalties were at the City end with the fans because suddenly, you know, I must have looked a bit bigger and the goal a bit smaller. And, you know, fortunately, I managed to save two and, you know, when we sort of fell over the line, if you like. But yeah, it was just a great moment, and I think it's always a chance for a sort of keeper to sort of be a hero, really, in a shootout. So there's no pressure whatsoever on a keeper.
Oh, I've got one more. I've just remembered. Sorry, just one more question on it. The yellow hat. What was all that about? You're wearing a yellow hat.
Yeah, I don't really know where that come from. and I, you know, and it was a shame to sort of cover up those lovely curtains I had at the time as well. You know, it was, I don't know where. So someone, I was, you know, I don't even know what it said on it. I'm actually gutted because I managed to keep my shirt, but I threw my boots and my gloves into the crowd. And I wish I'd kept those. But thankfully, I kept my shirt because I know Paul Dickoff swapped his shirt and he's never managed to get it back. So yeah, thankfully, I've got my shirt.
It's always funny that you wonder when you're watching it as a fan, you always think, you see some players wearing a wig or a silly hat and you think, how have they got hold of that? And if it falls off, they go and grab it and they put it back on. And you're right, Paul Dickoff, yeah, was wearing the Gillingham shirt in the celebrations. And I always think, surely you wish you were in your own kit for those celebrations and not the opposition's kit.
Yeah, like you said, I had a blue wig on as well at some point. I've seen a picture of me in a blue wig. I don't know what happened to that. So yeah, I think sponsors come up. People just give you stuff. You just put a scarf around your neck or, you know, a silly wig on or whatever. And to be honest, you're in such a happy place. You're not really bothered what you look like. Or obviously, you know, you're not bothered what anyone thinks because sort of life just doesn't get any better. And those moments, you know, I always say, like, try and tell the younger players now, when good moments come along, sort of treasure them because they don't come along very often. And when they do, they sort of over in a blink of an eye. But yeah, just when I think back, just absolutely, you know, fantastic memories and, you know, something that I'll treasure forever.
A battle of wits. Nicky Weaver against Tommy Lee. And Weaver smashes it in.
Oh, Nicky Weaver, and Bob Willis would have put that one, didn't he? Absolutely smashed it home. Keeping no chance at all.
Well, mate, this has been absolutely brilliant. Let's finish on what you're doing now. Goalkeeper coach at Sheffield Wednesday, of course. Earned your badges too. You're back home, really. You're back home at your beloved Sheffield Wednesday, your club. Must be a great feeling to be working there in a real proper capacity now.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm so lucky because, you know, I had 10 wonderful years at Man City, which is obviously the highlight of my career, bar none. But when I was a kid, I sort of dreamt of playing for Sheffield Wednesday. Fortunately enough, you know, I managed to do that. And then when I retired, I got offered a job in the academy, which I did. And now I'm working with the first team. So it's sort of, you know, I understand I'm a really lucky lad, you know, to be doing what I do. Hopefully I can sort of pass on bits of the knowledge that I sort of, that I got over my 19, 20 year career to the goalkeepers I work with. And, you know, thoroughly enjoy working with the manager, Gary Monk, who's been fantastic since he came in. And yeah, I never actually thought I would go into coaching, but it's something that I really enjoy. Nothing will ever beat playing, but it's sort of you know, the next best thing, I suppose.
And just a quick word on the goalkeepers you're working with, because I guess it's an interesting situation that you've got at Wednesday. You've effectively got three established first choice goalkeepers that you've been working with, so it must be quite an interesting challenge for you to work with the likes of Joe Wildsmith, Kieran Westwood, and of course Cameron Dawson, who's played the majority of this season. How have you found that challenge?
Yeah, well, I mean, I knew Cammy and Joe, working with them with the under, you know, 18s and 23s. I knew, in fact, they were just starting off on the journey when I was still playing for Wednesday. So I've known them, and Kieran Westwood was a young goalkeeper at Man City when I was there as well. So I knew them all very well before I went into the job. And they had all worked with me while I was doing my under 23s and under 18s as well. So yeah, the dynamic, I mean, Kieran obviously has had a great career. He's got 20 odd caps for Republic of Ireland. And Cammy and Joe are sort of making the way in the game. So the problem is, like you said, you've sort of got three number one goalkeepers there all vying for one spot. But it's a healthy rivalry. We all get on great. And yeah, fortunately, I don't have to make the decision who plays. That's up to the manager.
Andy Rhodes as well. I just want to very quickly ask you about Andy Rhodes. I know that he was there before you. Obviously, he left and you moved into that position. Correct me if I'm wrong here. This could be my mind playing tricks on me. Now, this might be something's better for a great 90s podcast called Quickly Kevin. They do a feature called Do I Remember This Right? And I remember watching the 1990 League Cup final where he played for Oldham. Did he do magic, Andy Rhodes? Was he ever doing magic? Or was he some form of magician? Am I remembering that completely wrong?
Not that I know of, but he used to mention that cup final about three times a day. So I certainly knew he played in that. But going back to Rhodesy, Rhodesy was brilliant for me in my career. He signed me. He was goalkeeping coach at Sheffield Wednesday when he signed me. And also when I went into coaching, I learned a lot of Rhodesy. The sort of detail that he's got within his coaching was brilliant. So yeah, another great coach. I worked with Rhodesy and, you know, really sort of a real good character.
Great stuff. Well, look, Nicky, it's been an absolute pleasure. We always finish with the same question that we ask everybody that we interview on this podcast. It's quite a broad question and we get a variety of answers. But the question is, Nicky Weaver, what has goalkeeping given you?
It's given me something to do because I weren't very good at school or anything else. But it's given me a wonderful career, some brilliant memories, you know, some great friendships that will last forever. And it's just given me a life in football that, you know, fortunately, you know, ever since I left school, I've, at the end of every month, the football club's put some money in my account and so it's given me a livelihood as well. So yeah, goalkeeping's given me everything I've got today and it's something that I love, something that I'm passionate about. And yeah, I'm a bit of a goalkeeping anorak sometimes and probably bore people to death with, you know, goalkeeping stories about gloves and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, goalkeeping's what I know about and well, I think I know about anyway. But yeah, he's given me everything I've got today, really. So yeah, very thankful for football and goalkeeping, I suppose, yeah.
Nicky Weaver, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Okay, well, that was Nicky Weaver. Before we get on to the reaction from Nicky Weaver and all those tales that he told, Rich, let's get on to you and Peter Schmeichel, because I'm sick of it. I'm absolutely sick of it. I like Peter Schmeichel, but I'm actually starting to dislike him a little because you mentioned you were a Peter Schmeichel fanboy. I'm putting a ban right here, right now, on you mentioning the 99 Champions League final for crying out loud. How many more times are you going to mention Mario Basler and that free kick? And every time you mention it, you say, no one talks about that. Yes, they do, mate. You do. You talk about it in every single podcast.
Matt, I think I've got a problem. It comes to me every day and I don't know why. And every single time we do one of these recordings, every road leads to Peter Schmeichel against Bayern Munich. I do not know why I keep talking about it. But I promise you, as of now, that is the last time I mention how things could have been different for Peter Schmeichel.
It's when you asked him as well about what he was like in training. I was like, oh no, here we go again. He's going to say that Peter Schmeichel comes in. He's an imposing character. He's a bit of a gentle giant, but I better not say that because he probably won't want me to refer to him as a gentle giant, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same thing every time, mate.
I know. I'm sorry. That is it. An apology. I will not mention Peter Schmeichel against Bayern Munich again. You have my word.
Good. I'm glad we got that cleared up. Let's get on to Nicky because that was a great chat. We tried to... Yeah. Avoid some of the classic cliches, scenarios that we always get into when talking to certain goalkeepers, especially Nicky Weaver. Now, I mentioned at the top of the podcast that he's spoken extensively about the playoff final. He's spoken a lot about David James and that moment against Middlesbrough. So whilst it's good to talk to him about that, you can hear that elsewhere. So I kind of wanted to get into the details around those moments, not specifically the moments themselves. But we'll start at the beginning because £42.50 a week at Mansfield. That's what he was on. Eventually moved on to City. Alex Stepney coming to watch him play, which must have been quite a nerve-wracking experience for a young goalkeeper at the time. But I touched on it there. As a 15-year-old, he showed incredible foresight to think, do you know what? I'm going to leave Sheffield Wednesday, my club, my hometown club, and move to Mansfield.
Yeah, huge. I mean, yeah. And it's I suppose when you look back on anyone's career, there's always going to be certain moments and, you know, good decisions, bad decisions. But of course, the path that Man City have taken, which is obviously largely down to Nicky Weaver and of course, the game that we touched on in such detail, but he joined such a good vehicle. And to have that opportunity, I mean, it just doesn't happen now. To go from a Mansfield to a Man City, even more so now, given the gap between the two clubs, you're looking at two or three clubs in between to make a jump like that. But it just doesn't happen. And you could tell when he was talking about the simple things effectively at City that he had when he moved there that just weren't in place at Mansfield. But credit to him, because as a 20-year-old goalkeeper, to step in, play, what do you say, 55 games in that opening season, which culminated in that classic game. I mean, it's fantastic. I'll tell you one of the big reasons for me that I think he was able to do that was his personality. And I think we've got a real good taste for it there in that podcast. He is a big personality. And I think that there are certain keepers that you can tell by the way in which they play, you get a bit of an idea of what they're like as a person. And I think that's the case with Nicky Weaver. Anyone that's seen him play, you can see he's a big character. The kind of character that you'd want in goal. Somebody that I can't imagine that mistakes would have got to him too much, for instance. You know, he gives that impression that he would brush it off very quickly, larger than life. And yeah, like you say, a thoroughly enjoyable chat.
And the character as well, to come back from that injury is remarkable, really. 5 years, nearly 5 years without a start in professional football. Came in and played that game against Chelsea. The fact that he had, what, 5, 6, 7 operations nearly by the end of it now. He said that he had one recently when he was at Sheffield Wednesday and hasn't really been the same since. But the fact that he's got a dead person's cartilage in his knee, the fact that he had to travel over to the US, the fact that he was talking to insurers, potentially fearing that at, what, the age of 25, his career could be over.
Yeah, I know. It's the, again, the highs and lows of goalkeeping. And I think he's had the real extremities, you know, and that's, again, we talk about character, personality. And he actually made the point, and it was interesting he touched on that, that he signed a long-term contract just before it. And, you know, you'd like to think that a club like City would have looked after him and kept him on board, even if he hadn't have done that. But I guess you got the impression that he'd set his mind as to, even when he had those first few breakdowns, it wouldn't have been nice. Each time you break down, you have to start again. It wouldn't have been nice, but I think he'd set in his mind, this is what it is for the foreseeable future. Now, look, I mean, you know, I say that, it's a bit of a random time. As of recording, we're in the middle of COVID-19, and I guess in some weird way, there's certain similarities where you just set your mindset as to something is what it is. And you get the impression with Nicky Weaver in that situation, he knew it was going to be a long time in the gym. And he's just made the most of that time in the gym, knowing that at some point, having belief that he would make his comeback. And he did. And not only did he make his comeback, he said 10 years he got out of the game after that. It just, it is an extraordinary, incredible story, the extremities that he's had to be go through. And I'm delighted that he stayed in the game. He said he wasn't sure if he was going to go into coaching. But the fact that he has, you can't help but feel that the likes of Cameron Dawson, of course, Wildsmith and Kieran Westwood are just going to really benefit from what he's been through.
Yeah, he has got plenty more stories as well. I like to think every time we do a podcast, we say the same thing, don't we? There's always going to be a part two. I'm sure, you know, at some point further down the line, we'll speak to Nicky Weaver again. There's plenty more stories that he's got from Scotland, from the time we mentioned with Dundee United and Aberdeen. He played with Charlton for a bit, must have so many stories from them. In fact, he was the quickest player ever to be sent off in Charlton's history when he got sent off in a game, I think around 2008, against Plymouth. That was only broken a couple of seasons ago by Naby Sarr, who got sent off after 39 seconds or something for Weaver. It was 3 minutes. But he held that record for a long time, for about 10 years. So I'm sure he's got stories of Alan Pardew, who signed him at Charlton, so many other stories. So I'm sure we'll get to that at a later date.
Indeed, we will. England under 21s as well, if I remember rightly.
Well, for a period, I think that, you know, it was him and Richard Wright, wasn't it? And a lot of critics were saying that maybe this was the heir to the David Seaman throne. He was going to be the next goalkeeper, really. And then, you know, David James was there. There were a dearth, really, of really good English goalkeepers at the time. You had David James, you had Nigel Martin coming to the end of his career. Robert Green was just starting to come through. Paul Robinson, of course, was another one of the regular goalkeepers there. But there was a period where it was him and Richard Wright as those two under 21 internationals.
Yeah, no, I remember that time really well. And I suppose for anyone out there that's my kind of age, I really looked up to Nicky Weaver and Richard Wright, funnily enough. I didn't have a picture of Nicky Weaver on my wall. I actually had a picture of Richard Wright on my wall. That is a true story when I was a young goalkeeper. I really admired him. And I think at that age, and it's funny to think that at the age of 20 for Nicky Weaver to have done what he did. I mean, it's such a shame from his point of view that he did have that injury. Because you do just wonder, had that not have happened, may he have had a bit more of a career at first team level, for instance, for England, given the start that he had to his career. But obviously, it is what it is. There's so many positives to his career. It's nice that we're able to touch on them.
It absolutely is. Rich, nothing but a pleasure as always.
Likewise.
This has been the Goalkeepers Union podcast. We'll see you next time.